Chapter 24. Henry Monk shifted his muscular frame to a different position on a long vinyl pad, stifled a yawn, and continued to stare out the Sappho One's aft viewport. The flat, unending sediment was about as interesting as a book without printed pages. But Monk took delight in the knowledge that every tiny mound, every rock or occasional denizen of the deep, measuring the outside salinity, temperature, sound velocity, and depth pressure on a magnetic tape. The sub-bottom profiler that acoustically determined the depth of the top sediments and provided indications of the underlying structure of the seafloor surface. The gravimeter that ticked off the gravity readings every quarter mile. The current sensor that kept its sensitive eye on the speed of the Lorelei current and direction. And the magnetometer, a sensor for measuring and recording the bottom's magnetic field, including any deviations caused by localized metal deposits. Monk almost missed it. The movement of the stylus on the magnetometer's graph was so slight, barely a tiny millimeter of a squibble, that he would have missed it completely if his eyes hadn't locked on the recording mark at exactly the right moment. Quickly, he threw his face against the viewport and peered at the sea floor. Then he turned and yelled at Giordino, who sat at the pilot's console only 10 feet away. All stop. Giordino spun around and stared aft. All he could see were Monk's legs. The rest of him was buried among the instruments. What do you read? We just passed over something that's metallic. Back her up for a closer look. Easing her back, Giordino said loudly so Monk could hear. He engaged the two motors mounted on each side of the hull amidships and set them at half speed in reverse. For 10 seconds, the Sappho One, caught in the 2-knot force of the current, hung suspended, reluctant to move on her own. Then she began to forge backward, very slowly, against the relentless flow. Gunn and the others crowded around Monk's instrument tunnel. "Make out anything?" Gunn asked. "Not sure," Monk answered. "There's something sticking up from the sediment about 20 yards astern. I can see only a vague shape under the stern lights." Everyone waited. It seemed an eternity before Monk spoke again. "Okay, I've got it." Gunn turned to Woodson. "Activate the 2 stereo bottom cameras and strobes. We should have this on film." Woodson nodded and moved off toward his equipment. "Can you describe it?" Spencer asked. "It looks like a funnel sticking upright in the ooze." Monk's voice came through the instrument tunnel disembodied, but even the reverberated tone could not disguise the excitement behind it. Gunn's expression went skeptical. "Funnel?" Drummer leaned over Gunn's shoulder. "What kind of funnel?" "A funnel with a hollow cone tapering to a point that you pour stuff through, you dumb rebel," Monk replied irritably. "It's passing under the starboard hull now. Tell Giordino to hold the boat stationary the second it appears under the bow viewports." Gunn stepped over to Giordino. "Can you hold our position?" "I'll give it a go, but if the current starts swinging us broadside, I won't be able to keep precise control, and we'll lose visual contact with whatever that thing is out there." Gunn moved to the bow and lay down on the rubber-sheathed floor. He stared out of one of the 4 forward viewports, together with Merker and Spencer. They all saw the object almost immediately. It was, as Monk had described it, simply an inverted, bell-shaped funnel about 5 inches in diameter, its tip protruding from the bottom sediment. Surprisingly, its condition was good. The exterior surface of the metal was tarnished, to be sure, but it appeared to be sound and solid, with no indication of flaking or heavy rust layers. "Holding steady," Giordino said, "but I can't guarantee for how long." Without turning from the viewport, Gunn motioned to Woodson, who was bent over a pair of cameras, zooming their lenses toward the object on the seafloor. "Omar?" "Focused and shooting." Merker twisted around and looked at Gunn. "Let's make a grab for it." Gunn remained silent, his nose almost touching the port. He seemed lost in concentration. Merker's eyes narrowed questioningly. "What about it, Rudy? I say let's grab it." The words finally penetrated Gunn's thoughts. "Yes, yes, by all means," he mumbled vaguely. Merker unhooked a metal box that was attached to the forward bulkhead by a 5-foot cable and positioned himself at the center viewpoint. The box contained a series of toggle switches that surrounded a small circular knob. It was the control unit for the manipulator, a 400-pound mechanical arm that hung grotesquely from the lower bow of the Sappho-1. Merker pushed a switch that activated the arm. Then he deftly moved his fingers over the controls as the mechanism hummed and the arm extended to its full 7-foot reach. It was 8 inches shy of the funnel in the sediment outside. "I need another foot," Merker said. "Get ready," Giordino replied. "The forward movement may break my position." The funnel seemed to pass with agonizing slowness under the manipulator's stainless steel claw. Merker gently eased the pincers over the lip of the funnel, and then he pressed another switch, and they closed. But his timing was off. The current clutched the submersible and began swinging it broadside. The claw missed by no more than an inch, and its pincers came together empty. "She's breaking to port," Giordino yelled. "I can't hold her." Quickly, Merker's fingers danced over the control box. He would have to try for a second grab on the fly. If he missed again, it would be next to impossible to relocate the funnel under the limited visibility. Sweat began erupting on his brow, and his hands grew tense. He bent the arm against its stop and turned the claw 6 degrees to starboard, compensating. One mistake, and the object would be lost on the sea floor forever. Then the slimy ooze relinquished its hold, and the funnel came free and rose up toward the viewports. "My God," Woodson whispered, "that's no funnel." "It looks like a horn," Merker said. Gunn shook his head. "It's a cornet." "How can you be sure?" Giordino had left the pilot's console and was peering over Gunn's shoulder through the port. "I played one in my high school band." The others recognized it now, too. They could readily make out the flaring mouth of the bell, and behind it the curved tubes leading to the valves and mouthpiece. "Judging from the look of it," Merker said, "I'd say it was brass." "That's why Monk's magnetometer barely picked it up on the graph," Giordino added. "The mouthpiece and the valve pistons are the only parts that contain iron."
"I wonder how long it's been down here," Drummer asked no one in particular.
"It'd be more intriguing to know where it came from," said Merker. "Obviously thrown overboard from a passing ship," Giordino said carelessly. "Probably by some kid who hated music lessons." "Maybe its owner is somewhere down here, too," Merker spoke without looking up. Spencer shivered. "There's a chilling thought for you." The interior of the Sappho-1 fell silent.